Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with my co-host, Susan Franson. Hello to you as the listener, and hello, Susan.
Hello, Ursula. Let's begin with the weather. Increasing cloudiness today with high near 15, wind chill values as low as minus 25, southwest wind 6 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, snow mainly after 4 a.m., low around 2, wind chill values as low as minus 10. South wind, 6 to 8 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 80%. New snow accumulation of less than a half inch possible. Saturday, snow, mainly before noon. High near 22. Wind chill values as low as minus 10. Chances of precipitation, 90%. New snow accumulation of 1 to 2 inches possible. Saturday night, mostly cloudy, with a low around minus 4. Wind chill values as low as minus 15.
Polar vortex? It's still ongoing. Let's brighten that chilly report by listening to a winter message from KHOI reporter and naturalist Pat Schlarbaum. Specifically in this case, he is going to tell us about our close but very wild neighbors, the white-tailed deer in winter.
Phenology is the chronicling of the dates of occurrences for plants and animals in our natural world. Nature's happenings like the first wallflower of the spring or the first butterfly are documented in a journal that includes those dates. Today's focus on phenology are the regal white-tailed bucks of Iowa. They will be shedding last year's set of antlers this time of winter. Finding shed deer antlers is a great thrill and offers special moments out of doors. The annual growth cycle for the white-tailed deer's antlers begins soon after the old rack has been shed. Antler buds for the new rack start growing from the pedicels, which are two permanent stumps of bone located on top of the buck's skull. A soft, hairy skin called velvet covers the antlers from the time they first appear as fuzzy knobs until they have reached full size. Growth is extremely fast, allowing the buck to produce his full rack in a few months. In late summer, the velvet begins shedding and gleaming tines are exposed. A buck's age, genetics, and diet are exhibited in his antlers. Also, worry is rub the velvet from his rack will stain the antler different colors. Cedar, willows, basswood, or other trees will provide differing hues of color to the rack. The hormone testosterone keeps antlers firmly attached to the buck's head. However, when breeding season ends in late autumn, all that changes. Production of the hormone stops. Bone at the base of each antler erodes or wears away, and the rack is ready to be shed. People enjoying a midwinter walk may find one of these special gifts of the land. Areas where deer congregate or yard up during frigid weather are good areas to focus upon. Also, next to field margins, fence lines, or food plots are good places to look for shed deer antlers. Look under cedar groves where a low branch may entangle and dislodge an antler. It's been said that when antlers are shed, its match can sometimes be located within 150 yards. Searching in ever-increasing concentric circles from the spot of the first antler is a proven method of success. Native people used antlers for tools and pieces of antler for jewelry. They considered removal of an antler as a special gift and would return sacred tobacco to the spot in appreciation. Wherever deer antlers are shed, mammals like mice and squirrels are in search of antlers for the precious minerals they contain. For the modern conservationist that wants to give something back to the environment, a bit of mineral block can be placed where antlers are taken. And of course, if the shed antler goes undetected, its minerals will one day provide soil nutrients to grow the plants that a buck may eat to provide nourishment for his growing antlers. Such are the cycles of nature. Seeking elusive shed antlers of deer can bring hours of great exercise and can tell us much about the habits and genetics of white-tailed bucks. It is another form of deer hunting, and the big one is still out there for all to see, renewing a cycle of nature as a critical asset to Iowa's woodlands. And that's our focus on phenology for Friday, February 7th.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, events, and stories of Central Iowa. That was Patch Larbaum from the Department of Natural Resources, giving us an update on the events in the natural world. Thank you for listening. Today we'll look at three diverse topics during the show. Our first guest on the show is Shirley Shaw, who will tell us about the Red Friars Valentine dinner dance.
After that, we will take an in-depth look at a criminal case from the past in Story County that has recently reemerged in the news, the case of Yvette Louisel. To better understand the case and its implications, we will hear from the former Story County attorney who convicted Louisel, Mary Richards, the present Story County attorney, Steve Holmes, and ISU adjunct psychology teacher, Douglas Gentile, to explain brain research relevant to this case.
Then we'll close out the program with an installment of KHOI's monthly Community Service Appreciation Program, where we bring you information about a local service group that is making a significant contribution. This month we are featuring the National Association for the Mentally Ill, or otherwise known as NAMI.
While we're waiting to be connected with Shirley Shaw, let's hear a little music from Red Friars, Papa Loves Mambo. This is Local Talk on KHOI, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Thank you for listening in. Shirley Shaw from the Red Friars has joined us by telephone. Shirley is here to tell us about Red Friars and their Valentine's Day dance. Hello, Shirley.
Good morning.
Good morning. Let's start out by telling about the dance that's coming up.
Oh, I'd love to talk about that. A dance club in town is sponsoring an open dance on next Friday, Friday the 14th, Valentine's Day. It will be a sweetheart dinner dance, and it's held at the Moose Lodge, which is out on 69, North 69, at about 190th Street, past Ada Hayden Lake, where the Old Oaks Golf Course was, for those who know that landmark. We have live music, Galen Sudik and his quintet, and they play all kind of music from the 40s through the 60s. It will be preceded by a prime rib dinner. Now, we'd love to have everybody come to the dinner and the dance, but if the dance is the only thing they can get to, you can come later. The dance starts at 7. The dinner starts at 6. The dance starts at 7. For the dinner, of course, reservations are required. Anybody interested with any questions at all can call me at 292-2333. And everybody wants to know what to wear. And what we say is dress to impress your sweetheart.
Shirley, would you repeat the phone number, please?
That's 515-292-2333.
You said it's a prime rib dinner. I assume, mm-hmm. though, that if there aren't any vegetarians around, is there something for them to eat?
Yes, of course. They can designate that, not only vegetarian, but gluten-free, if need be.
Shirley, what are the Red Friars?
Well, Red Friars is a dance club that has been in Ames for 80 years. Actually, this is the year they're celebrating their 80th anniversary. And the name originated, if I can recollect, after a secret society at Duke University that was established in 1913. And the effort was to create a bridge between faculty and students and develop a sense of fellowship. Why a dance club would choose that, I don't know. When Red Friars began, it used to be a very, very formal organization. You had to be recommended by somebody. You had to fill out an application. Women wore formals. Men wore tuxedos. There were dance programs. Each woman carried her little dance program, and men had to sign up to dance for her. Albeit they were all couples that came, they did share partners throughout the evening. We used to meet on Thursday night, and I remember when we joined, we were young, we joined like maybe 50, 48 years ago, and Thursday night just seemed like a strange time to get all dressed up when you had to go to work the next day. So we dropped out until it became a Friday night affair. And for years, we met at the union. That was at the student union in various places. Now, for the last 3 years, we've been meeting out at the Moose Hall, which, by the way, might not sound very formal, but they have the most wonderful dance floor that we've been on. We have a lot of fun, and the Moose has been just very wonderful to us, very hospitable. They go out of their way to please us.
So this is quite a tradition that's being carried on.
It's quite a tradition. We're celebrating our 80th year this year.
You said you had played all kind of music, and we'd like to put people in the mood with Let's Dance.
Thank you for joining us, and just as we go out, give again the specifics of when and where the dance is.
Yes, I will do that.
Okay.
So the dance is next Friday, February the 14th, at the Moose Lodge, live music, dinner dance, or dance, and you can get more information by calling 515-292-2333. That's 2333.
And everybody's invited.
Everybody's invited.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you, Shirley.
Okay, you bet.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with my co-host, Susan Franson.
Last weekend, a criminal case in Story County was front page news in the papers. Yvette Louiselle, convicted of murder in 1988 when she was a teenager, is now a subject of news again. Recently, her life sentence had come into question in response to the U.S. Supreme Court ruling made in 2011. The case was Miller versus Alabama, dealing with a 14-year-old convicted of murder in Alabama. The U.S. Supreme Court then overturned a life conviction without parole for a murder committed by that young man and ruled that it was in violation of the Eighth Amendment in the Constitution. The Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. This case is affecting our local community now in the form of Yvette Louiselle's situation and her possible release because of that federal court ruling. Former Story County Attorney Mary Richards is here in the studio with us today to help us understand the situation. Mrs. Richards was prosecuting attorney for the conviction of Louisel 26 years ago. Thank you for coming to us, Mary.
You're quite welcome.
Would you please explain what happened when you tried the case in 1988?
We examined the evidence, determined what we felt was the appropriate charge, and then presented the case with that in mind. And the facts of the case clearly were first-degree murder. That's what Yvette Louisel was convicted of. And the laws of Iowa, that is, the laws that had been passed by the legislature, said that for first-degree murder in this state, the punishment should be life in prison without possibility of parole. At one time, Iowa was a capital punishment state. We did have a death penalty before, I think, 1968. I'm not positive about that. But at the time that the law was changed, the legislature decided that the appropriate sentence would be life in prison without possibility of parole.
So, Mary, essentially, what we're saying here is that because the U.S. Supreme Court made this ruling, this now is potentially affecting us on the local level. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the reason, of course, is that the Supreme Court of the United States is the final authority on what is constitutional under the U.S. Constitution. And all states are bound not only by their own constitutions, but also by the Constitution of the United States.
I think we've skipped over one very significant fact about this case, and that is that Yvette Louisel was only 17 when she committed this crime. And because the juvenile code doesn't have any provision for homicides, she was
transferred to the adult court.
Yes.
Yes. It's not that the juvenile code does not have provision for homicides. It's that at the time, the juvenile law in Iowa did not allow any recognition or any imposition of punishment much beyond the age of majority, much beyond 18, which meant that a person who committed a very serious offense when they were 17, let's say a few months shy of adulthood, there really were very few options to respond to that kind of behavior. You either had to free them when they were 18 with very little response to the behavior, or you had to transfer them to adult court.
So automatically the sentence given when they were juvenile wouldn't apply to them once they became an adult. That's what you're saying?
Oh, that's correct. I mean, mm-hmm. If they are sentenced in juvenile court, the rules of juvenile court would apply.
Now, Mary, it's also interesting that recently, in this particular case, you testified in favor of Louisel's release. Can you explain briefly?
First of all, I would say that there are about five different reasons for imposing punishments in court cases for criminal behavior that a person has committed. One is protection of the community. That's an obvious one that I think everyone recognizes. In my estimation, there is no likelihood of any further harm done to persons in the community by Yvette Louisel. Second would be deterrence. And deterrence is usually viewed as punishing one person in order to make an example so that other people will not commit this offense. There have been numerous studies over the years that show that the death penalty in criminal cases has no effect whatsoever on other people committing the same offense. And so that does not apply. The third one that I'm going to mention, and it would be a proportionate punishment, a recognition by the community that a person has committed a bad act and should suffer some consequences. And that really is where we come down to in this particular case. How much punishment for the offense that was committed is appropriate? So that's basically, I think, the nub of it. I think the other possible reasons for imposing a punishment are no longer relevant in this case. One of them, for instance, is, which I think has no place in a civilized society, is just retribution, revenge, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. That certainly still is the way many of us would feel individually, but I think that a civilized society should not be considering that as its reason for punishing someone.
So you're saying that you feel that she's been punished enough?
I think in her case that's correct, because the fifth is the ability to rehabilitate a person. And I think all of the evidence indicates that Yvette Loisel has been, and has done it much herself, rehabilitated during her term of imprisonment.
It's interesting. She was convicted in 1988, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Well, there's a lot of aspects to this case. We're discussing the Yvette Loisel case here on Local Talk, and with us is former county attorney who convicted Loisel, Mary Richards. Before we go on, I'd like to read an email sent to us by Beth Wessel-Crochelle, who's an Iowa House representative for District 45, which contains much of Ames. Ms. Wessel-Crochelle is a member of the House Judiciary Committee, and it's a fairly long and complicated email, so I'd like Susan to read it and break it down with questions as we go.
I'd like you to ask the questions,
okay,
and I'll read, and then they'll know who's who's asked. Okay. Yvette Loisel was convicted of first-degree murder for a stabbing that she committed as a 17-year-old in 1987. In 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court decided Miller versus Alabama, and in that finding, they found that under the cruel and unusual punishment prohibition in the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, sentencing of a juvenile to mandatory life in prison without a possibility of parole, as Yvette Loisel was sentenced, was unconstitutional.
So are there crimes besides murder for which juveniles in Iowa have received life sentences? Do you know, Mary?
Well, the possibilities are anything that is a Class A offense. Another would be kidnapping that results in injury, or kidnapping for various, you know, for purposes of sexual assault, for instance. So anything that is a Class A felony categorized under that. There are not many offenses, but there are some other than felony murder.
And second-degree murder, too.
Second-degree murder is not classified as murder, as life in prison without possibility of parole. It's a Class B felony, I believe.
Well, let's go on. What the email says is, while the court did not appear to go as far as it did for non-homicide offenses and declare all such punishments unconstitutional, the Supreme Court did make mandatory imposition of life sentences unconstitutional.
So does this mean that juveniles can still be sentenced to life in prison for murder?
Well, as a matter of fact, what the sentence will be, and the sentence that was imposed by Judge Ellefson after the resentencing hearing, was life in prison with the possibility of parole.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
After 25 years. That's
no, what, well,
in his, didn't he?
But that's not the case for all cases. The sentence would be life in prison without possibility of parole. And he determined that there should be a minimum sentence in this case, and he set it at 25 years.
Now, this is what I think is the really confusing part. The U.S. Supreme Court then sent these homicides involving juveniles back to the state courts to determine the appropriate penalty in each case individually. Now, was this part of Miller versus Alabama?
It means that the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court case, is controlling. And so that persons sentenced in the states that had, you realize not every state has that kind of sentencing. That it's going to be life in prison without possibility of parole. Some states would still have, they no longer do, but they would have had laws that said a person who committed an offense while a teenager could be put to death. Of course, that ruling came down from the Supreme Court, I don't know how many years ago, but at any rate, that's declared unconstitutional as cruel and unusual punishment. There are some states that have never said you're going to have to spend life in prison without the possibility of parole. So this applies only to those states that have the kind of sentence for capital punishment like as that we do.
Yeah, which includes Iowa.
That's right.
So just to, for those of us who aren't that clear on the law, when a Supreme Court makes a ruling like this, does that just automatically mean that from then on it will be like that on in the state courts? There doesn't have to be any other procedure.
That's correct. They are the last word.
And is this then retroactive or only from going forward?
It depends entirely on the case. Sometimes the issue of retroactivity is discussed in the case. Sometimes that's up for grabs. There will be another case that will determine whether or not it should be imposed retroactively.
So that, in a way, is what we're dealing with here with the Louis L. case, right? That ambiguity of what happens retroactively in a case like this.
If the state appeals,
yeah.
Yes, that's probably okay. What at least one of the grounds would be.
Uh-huh.
Well, the email ends by saying, in the Yvette Louisel case, a Story County District Court judge resentenced her to 25 years in prison in January. With the time that she has already served, I believe she will be eligible to be released on February 10th. And the paper's front pages and headlines indicated that that was what was going to happen.
Is that really the case, Mary?
Well, as of about 5:34 last evening, it is not the case, because the court issued a stay of carrying out Judge Ellefson's order until the state can appeal. I can't tell you much more than that, but I noticed that that was the most recent thing that had happened, and it was just yesterday, late yesterday afternoon, that the court issued that stay.
So who are the key people at this point determining what will happen?
Well, this will be appealed. It will be, the appeal will be heard in the district court, and then in Iowa, of course, our next court, our a next possible appeal by either party, would be to our Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court, the Iowa Supreme Court, would decide whether they want the case to be heard by the Court of Appeals, or whether they want to hear the case themselves.
So this could potentially go to the Supreme Court of Iowa.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, the articles that I read mentioned this this appeal that we're talking about, and I noticed that your successor, County Attorney Stephen Holmes, felt very strongly that the Attorney General should bring the appeal. So I interviewed him. And he was very emphatic about his reasons and very helpful in my understanding of the case. And I'd like to play a brief, very brief clip from him with his central concerns.
It's true. I have objected to these proceedings. Most all of my objections are procedural, legal, and constitutional in nature, which I think is difficult to explain, but I'm certainly willing to try.
Thank you, Stephen Holmes. We appreciate your statement, and unfortunately, the explanation that you gave, which was very, very helpful to me and informed my work on this program, was too much for me to successfully condense. So thank you for your time and your help.
Can you explain briefly what his objections were?
Well, he said they're procedural, legal, and constitutional. So it
has to do with how it's being implemented.
It has to do with the legalities of how the case was handled. It has to do with the procedures that were used.
Mm-hmm. And it has to do, he kept mentioning the 14th Amendment, due process. He didn't feel that this was due process. He felt that it was the separation of powers that was important, that the courts were taking over the duties of the legislature by deciding how long sentences should be, and they were, they'd overridden the governor who granted reduction of sentence to 60 years, a parole after 60 years rather than life imprisonment, which was declared to be also cruel and unusual punishment by the Iowa Supreme Court. And that's where the 25 years first came in.
So it sounds like Mr. Holmes stressed that it was important to delay the sentencing until the legislature had set new sentencing guidelines.
Exactly.
Right.
And that I was fortunate to get hold of Beth Wessel-Crischel yesterday, and she told about where this is with the legislature. And last year, the legislature had a bill that would have required a person to serve at least 45 years before parole, that the county attorneys were going to support a proposal to make that minimum prison requirement 35 years this year, although I do not believe I have seen an actual bill on that topic on the House side yet. So apparently, if this goes to the appeal, and they abide by what's likely to happen in the legislature, Ms. Yvette Lewisell will have 10 to 20 years more. But that's the due process may determine something else. And so it's still up in the air. It's still a cliffhanger. And those who care about it will be watching very closely. Before we end this part of the program, I'd like to include an interview with Doug Gentile, developmental psychologist who dealt with another important aspect of this case. In the Supreme Court decision, they mentioned their decision was based partly on new brain research. So I asked him to talk about that in connection with juveniles.
Well, I think all parents recognize that teenagers are strange creatures, and that, in fact, many times teenagers will do crazy things. And when parents ask them, why did you do that crazy thing? Teenagers actually give the honest answer. Their answer is, I don't know. And that's actually the correct answer. They really don't know. They are not able, in the same way an adult brain is, to think about what they're planning to do, what would the consequences be if they did it, and should they do that and accept those consequences? They really can't do that. Because part of the brain that's not yet developed is the impulse control area. You can think of that kind of as the brakes in the brain. Well, what else is happening in the teenage brain? Well, you've got all the hormones and pressures of adolescence. That's the gas. All gas, no brakes. You now understand teenagers.
The Supreme Court's decision basically said there could not be mandatory life sentences without parole for teenagers,
mm-hmm.
but adults can still have them.
Mm-hmm.
So is there something magic that happens to people when they turn 18?
No. In fact, the brain research suggests it's not until they hit about age 25 that their brain really can do all of that more complicated logical reasoning and impulse control and planning based on consequences, which is why college students do a lot of crazy things too, because essentially their brains are still teenage brains.
Well, in terms of the crime and punishment aspect, then even any life sentences without parole don't make sense, or is that not true?
Well, that's a political decision, really. When we think about punishments fitting the crime, there is a sense of fairness, there's a sense of justice, there's something that that comes down to our sense of morality, and people will differ on those types of judgments because there isn't an absolute in human society about what type of crime should get exactly what type of punishment. And so I guess a lot of that comes down to the questions about, well, what do we think prison is doing? Is it really rehabilitating, in which case the idea of life sentence without parole makes sense for no one? Or if we think it really is just a punishment, we're not really trying to rehabilitate, we are really just trying to punish, then it can make sense. And so the question then, you know, gets even more thorny once we talk about, well, whom should we try as an adult and why? And usually we try cases that we find morally offensive or more heinous. We're more outraged. So we sense that we need a bigger punishment to offset what we find offensive. And so this is why many youth do get tried as adults, even though clearly they aren't adults yet.
Mary, could you give us a little bit of an overview of the meaning of this? Clearly, there's the issue of rehabilitation, which on some level I think you have responded to in the sense of feeling that enough punishment has occurred in this particular case. And then on another level, there's really the question of when the Supreme Court makes a ruling, how does that really end up affecting individual cases for the public good. And I was wondering if you could help us wrap up this part of the show with kind of your feeling about what this all adds up to.
I think Dr. Gentile has very succinctly stated the issues in terms of why the laws are changing with regard to young persons. And that's in response, really, to new things that we have learned. And I think that's a good thing for people to remember. The law does not stay static. And even though there's a common statement, the wheels of justice grind slow. And that's true. I mean, often what's happening in our justice system may be lagging behind the changes in our society or what we understand is appropriate behavior, that sort of thing, and what is appropriate punishment for particular kinds of behavior at different times in a person's life, which is what is happening with this particular case. But by and large, if a justice system were not able to adapt to what current knowledge is about human behavior, for instance, and what is accepted behavior, then it really would not serve us very well. And so that's what's happening in this case. And it's appropriate, I think, that it lags behind and it takes a while, because that way we are not facing issues that are fads or a knee-jerk reaction, let's say, by the public to a lot of things. So I think it looks like a messy process, but in the long run, it's one that serves us well.
And is there a benefit to waiting until this goes all the way through to the legislature to make sure that there's really a thorough responsible shift?
Till it goes all the way through the legislature? You mean till the legislature decides what it thinks should be an appropriate minimum?
Right.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm a person who should respond to that. I think that's everybody's. And everybody's going to have their own opinion, just as Dr. Gentile said. People have differing opinions about what is appropriate punishment. And so I don't think I'm qualified to say.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's interesting how these situations really are about the public good and open to interpretation. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Mary, for joining us and helping us kind of sort this out.
You are quite welcome. I'm glad to do it.
And we should say that Mary also has a show on KHOI, the Community Bookshelf.
I do. Can I put in a plug?
Absolutely.
Every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evenings right now at 8 o'clock, you can hear the Community Bookshelf. We feature local authors, and the narrators are also local, sometimes the authors themselves. We have fun. We hope people tune in and have fun, too.
And if you have not heard that show before, I really recommend you try it. It's absolutely wonderful to hear what Iowans are writing.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye, Mary.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. In the last part of our show, we are going to focus on the National Association for the Mentally Ill, NAMI, as part of KHOI's Community Service Appreciation Program. KHOI reporter Kay Puttock submitted this recorded interview.
I'm Kay Puttock, and this month for our Community Service Appreciation Program segment, our focus is on NAMI-CI, which stands for the National Alliance for Mental Illness in Central Iowa. And I'm here today with Deb Niehoff, who's the Executive Director of NAMI-CI, and she's going to tell us about this organization and what it does for people and families who are living with mental illness in Central Iowa.
Okay, NAMI Central Iowa has a mission, and the mission is to provide support and education and advocacy for people who are affected by mental illness, both individuals living with mental illness and their family members. We do that in a number of ways. We provide support through support groups. Every week we have a support group for individuals living with mental illness. And once a month we have one for family members. And we also give individual support at the office. And we have a mental health wellness center, which provides support by providing programs on a daily basis that have a whole health focus for people living with mental illness. In terms of education, we have several educational classes that we offer on pretty much an annual basis. Family to Family is a 12-session class for family members. Peer to Peer is a 10-session class for individuals living with mental illness. And Basics is a new 6-session class for parents and caregivers of children and adolescents who are experiencing behavioral or emotional or mental disorders. Our advocacy shows itself in keeping in touch with legislators, and during election years, we have a candidates forum that deals with disability issues and questions.
Could you say a bit more about what goes on at the Welcome Center?
Okay. It's a wellness center, and we don't like to call it just a drop-in center because it's not just a place for folks to drop in and hang out. We have programs every day that have been shown to be connected with mental health recovery. So we have art programs, art therapy. We have a writing group. We offer exercise classes. We talk about nutrition. So a lot of different things, and every day it's a different program. We have a calendar that comes out at the beginning of the month so that people know what will happen each day, and they come for those activities that they find helpful.
And that goes on every day. Weekends as well?
No, weekdays, afternoons from 1 to 4.
But people can drop in also, right?
Yes, they can. Yes, if people are just wondering what's happening, what it's like, they obviously can come and drop in. We hope that they will participate in programs. We always encourage that. But if someone is not feeling well on a certain day and just needs to be with people, certainly they can. We have easy chairs where they can sit, and we also have a quiet room that's just set aside for people who don't want to be around a lot of other people.
Right. And the people can go there, and there's other people there that understand, presumably.
At the center, yes, yeah. Everyone there understands, even the person who is the coordinator. He is an individual who lives with mental illness. And that's, I guess, one of the unique things about NAMI. Everything that we offer is led by people who have had the lived experience of who they're working with. So it's either a trained family member or a trained individual living with mental illness, leading support groups, leading classes. And because of that, we use lots and lots of volunteers, and so everything we offer is able to be done at no charge to the individuals.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I can't remember who it was, but there was someone from the sheriff's office was saying that sometimes when they're called to a house because there's a crisis of someone with mental illness, sometimes they take them to the center if it's open because there's someone there that understands. I don't know if he meant right away if it's really a crisis situation.
No, they recommend it. They let people know about the center, but we've not had anyone bring someone directly. But we definitely have had a number of people who have been recommended to come and to participate at the center through Ames police officers, ISU, or the county.
Now, when I was at the Wellness Center, I noticed some very interesting art on the walls, which presumably was produced at one of these classes. I wonder if you'd like to say a bit more about that. That was very interesting work.
Well, we have, like I said, a person who does art therapy and another woman who does just a miscellaneous art activity each month. And in April, we do a program called Recovery Through the Arts. And so at that time, they take some of the things that have been produced during the year and do a really nice job of matting and framing things and displaying them so that people have that pride in their work and they can tell people about what it was that they did, the materials that they used, and also what it meant to them.
I should imagine that for people that do come there for the first time, seeing this kind of very honest art on the walls helps them understand their own situation and make them realize they're not alone and so on.
Yes, one whole wall is filled with self-portraits, and it's, you know, if you were to see them, it's people's faces, and it's just kind of sliced in half, and on one side they have shown how they feel on a good day, and on another side they show how they feel when their symptoms are really raising themselves up.
Okay. Now, can you say a bit more about the classes? Now, I have taught one of those classes for family members. Because I have a son with bipolar disorder, though he seems to be doing okay these days. But could you say a bit more about the classes and how those developed?
Yeah, NAMI Central Iowa is actually an affiliate of a national organization, and we're one of about 1,100 affiliates. And so at the national level, classes have been developed and gone under pretty strict studies to make sure that everything is up to date. And then those are available to the affiliates. And what happens is the state organization here, NAMI Iowa, will hold trainings so that people who are family members and would like to teach that family-to-family class can come for a weekend and get trained on how to teach it. And the same with the peer-to-peer and the basics. So they're really, really well thought out educational classes. The participants come and get a lot of handouts. They end up with a nice fat notebook of information. They're different than a support group in that they are very much educationally focused, and people can learn about how the brain works, about how medications affect the brain, about how to communicate, just a lot of things that aren't available anywhere else. You know, the medical profession is wonderful in what they do, but they do not have the time to do the kinds of education for family members or even for the individuals living with mental illness.
Yes, and if you do have a family member with mental illness, or if you yourself are living with mental illness, it could be, I won't say a full-time job, but it could be a very long job just finding out and doing the research about how to get help and where to turn and all that sort of thing.
Yes, yes, it is. We talk about it being a maze for people to kind of work their way through. So one of the things we do in the classes is we put together a crisis folder, and one page of that is a whole sheet of all of the numbers to be called here in Story County if someone is experiencing a crisis in one way or another, trying to get all that information in one place so when people need it, they can just grab that piece of paper and call who they need.
Have you noticed that people keep coming to the wellness center? I mean, regularly, you know, they finish one class, they maybe take another. In other words, is it an ongoing, you know, something that's always there for them? Or is it a take a class and then they stop coming? Or how does it work?
Well, I should differentiate between classes and the programs that we offer at the center. Mm-hmm. So the center does not have these classes. Those are separate, those educational classes. So what we have is one day a week is a writing group, and one day is a week is the support group.
See.
So it's not ongoing classes.
I see.
So they come and they participate in whatever they're interested in. Some of them may come just on Thursdays for the support group. And I would say, yes, there are a few who come and see what it's all about and pick up a calendar and we don't see them again. Others will find a particular activity that they like, so they'll come just on those days. And others are very regular. We have probably five or six who come almost every day. They say it's their reason to get up in the morning. It's their way to get out of isolation and be around other people in a place that's safe because people understand them.
And now you yourself, you are there in the morning in the office for people that want to talk to you, right?
Yes, yes. I'm in the office and, you know, doing a lot of administrative things, but I love to talk to people and give support and tell them about our classes and support groups and maybe help them find whatever they need resources in town. So I'm, you know, available through phone and email. And if people want to make an appointment, I'm happy to meet with people. Sometimes, you know, people have not had opportunity to share their story, and, you know, it's a safe place because I, too, have a child with bipolar disorder. And so I understand what people are saying, and I don't get shocked by what they're experiencing. There are some difficult experiences associated with mental illness.
And you have a library there, too.
We have a small library. We have videos and books. We also subscribe to several different magazines, and those are all available for people to check out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How many people would you say use the center every day, or maybe, you know, on the average in a week?
My numbers are more by the month, and we, I think right now, are running about 150 visits a month. So I don't really count it by week, but each month we get a report at the board meeting. And we have to keep track of how many individuals use the center. And last year when we counted up, It was over 90 different individuals. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they're not there every day or even every month, but that's how many people took advantage of the resources there.
It's a big contribution to the community since the center is open. It hasn't been open very long. I think you mentioned when
we're just into our third year. Yeah. Okay. In August, we celebrated 2 years. So, no, it hasn't been open real long. It is something that a number of people in the community were wanting. It used to be that Mary Greeley offered one, but that closed down probably 10 years ago. And so.
Why that was? Why it closed down? The space or?
No, because it wasn't at the hospital. My understanding is that the woman who was running it, who actually was a psychiatric nurse, mm-hmm. decided to retire and they did not replace her.
Oh, I see.
So ours is a little bit different in that we don't have the medical personnel. We have a person who's got the lived experience.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Deb, for coming to talk to us. I've been talking to Deb Niehoff, the Executive Director of NAMI of Central Iowa. That's the National Alliance for Mental Illness in Central Iowa. NAMI supports and educates people affected by mental illness, educates the public about mental health issues, and advocates for people affected by mental illness. The NAMI CI Wellness Center is at 416 Douglas Avenue, right near the KHOI studio, in fact, on the same street. Thank you again for talking to us, Deb. I'm Kay Puttock, and for the next segment of our program about NAMI CI, I'll be talking with one of the people who teach art therapy there.
You are listening to KHOI Community Radio. Today, we have been talking about Red Friars, developments in the case of Yvette Lewisell, and the ongoing efforts to develop Iowa laws in the spirit of the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision on juvenile sentencing, and a report on the community organization we are focusing on this month, National Association for the Mentally Ill, NAMI.
We have been speaking with Shirley Shaw from the Red Friars, Mary Richards, former Story County Attorney, Steve Holmes, Story County Attorney at this time, Doug Gentile, developmental psychologist, and special thanks to Representative Beth Wessel Crochelle and her staff for their report from the Judicial Committee of the Legislature. Deborah Niehoff spoke with us from the National Association for the Mentally Ill. Reporters for today were Patch Larbaum, Kay Patak, and myself, Ursula Rudenberg, and Susan Franson. Local Talk is engineered by Richard Morrison and Becca Brown.
Music you heard was Papa Loves Mambo by Enrico Domingo and his big band on the CD Strictly Dancing, Let's Dance by Glenn Gray from his CD Swing Time. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. And see listings of our past guests and resource contact information, as well as other resources mentioned on our shows. If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and consider becoming one of the 500 families.
Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or email us at khoiradio@gmail.com. Your participation, as always, as the audience, is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.